Welcome to Cover Girls, Drinking and Overthinking, in which we take a story we love and analyze how well it was adapted.
I'm Chris.
I'm Kristen.
And I'm Allison. Join us as we meticulously pick apart our favorite stories until no stone is left unturned. It'll be bookish.
It'll be boozy.
It'll be bantersome.
And it won't be boring. So grab a drink and get ready to overthink. Let's dig in. All right, welcome back again. Can't believe you're still listening to us, guys. In this episode, we are covering chapters 10 through 22. How are you gals feeling?
Great. That is so many chapters for number of pages. These chapters are tiny.
They're so tiny.
I do wonder why you broke them up so small. It's interesting.
That is interesting. I also feel like, is that beneficial? What does it add?
It's a kid's book, you know, maybe that was the point to like make it easy for kids to read.
Yeah, they read two pages and they're like, oh, I read a whole chapter.
Yeah. You feel very accomplished.
Feels doable.
Yeah. Unlike those holes, which just seem to never end. Okay, so I think we are going to be able to dive right in. You guys, if you've been paying attention, you know that we're kind of batch recording. So this is our second episode and final episode tonight. So I think we just get straight into introducing our drinks.
Yes.
So you want to go first?
Allison, you go first.
Me go first?
Yes, you go first.
She knows I'm excited to share mine. I've been planning this one for a while. So in this section, we get the epic moment where the warden strikes Mr. Sir across the face with the rattlesnake venom on her nails. And ever since then, I've been wanting to do a snake bite for this episode. Now, for those of you who have never had a snake bite before, and I'm showing this on the screen to the Kristens, this is half cider and half Guinness. The bottom half is cider. That's why it's lighter. The top half is Guinness. If I could have found, it's a British drink. If I could have found a proper like British cider, like Strongbow or something, I would have done that. But instead I got a local Austin East ciders and then did
very
Guinness
apropos.
On the top half.
That's
mine.
And very beautifully poured, I might add.
Thank you. There's a little head too. Thank you very much.
Head.
Very much. Who's excited to go next?
I'm excited to go next.
Okay, Chris, lay it on us.
So Allison was actually my bartender because I had to put my daughter down for the night. But I did choose this drink
and she just made it. It was her recipe.
But she made it well. It's called a French kiss, which I thought was appropriate for kissing Kate Barlow. And it's really beautiful. I don't know if y'all can see it. It's Prosecco Tito's vodka. I have to promote Tito's since my husband works with them. And raspberries and lemon. And it is just so refreshing. And it's given me a kiss on the inside of my mouth.
Must add, it is fresh squeezed lemon. It's not out of a bottle, baby. That's half of a full lemon fresh squeezed.
Very nice. Well, I don't have a bartender like you guys do. And I also don't have 80 bottles of bourbon lying around. But
more. We did some.
Yeah, hold on. Before you go,
did you count?
We asked Jordan, Chris, can you reveal what he said when we asked?
So he said that it was actually closer to Allison's original guess. What did he say? 120?
At least 120. Woof. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So wow. I just didn't count that correctly. I guess I was optimistic and thought there was in this house.
I still overshot it, but that's a lot. Oh my God.
I mean, you didn't overshoot by much, apparently. So anyways, I'm sorry, Kristen, what are you drinking?
I've mixed together an artisan little thing. You guys might not have heard of this drink. It's a little esoteric. It's called a LaCroix. That's the French for it. It's a little lime water, a little carbonated soda. You know, I wouldn't expect you guys to have heard of it. It's pretty high level. And it is key lime, by the way, which I think is their way of saying lime and vanilla, but it's actually really good.
You know what? Those boys at Camp Green Lake would have killed for that LaCroix.
Oh my God, that's so true.
That's why I picked it.
Yes.
Yay. Shall we dive straight in?
Please. Let's dive into the lake.
So we were talking on the break, and actually, I agree, not much happens in Chapter 10. So listeners, we've got a few pages here that pretty much just goes over caveman, like, finding the fossil and thinking it's a thing. It's not. There was one little quote I wanted to point out was, he looked back down at the fish. He'd found his miracle, because he really thinks this is something interesting and valuable. And I try to put myself in a child's shoes who doesn't know what they're looking for. And this does seem like a miracle. This is actually a really incredible fossil. It has all the little bones in it. It's a very detailed fossil. This seems extremely cool and valuable to a kid. And he's so excited. And of course, he just doesn't understand what's going on. Oh, that just broke my heart.
It's a bummer.
Yeah. And by the end of it, he is still at the back of the waterline by page 51. So he hasn't moved up past zero yet at all. So chapter 11. So we get some interesting depth to X-Ray's character. I would love for you guys to speak on this. Readers, I'll just read you the quote and open the floor. X-Ray basically asks Stanley to bring anything he finds to him. And he says he's never found anything because his eyesight's not so good. No one knows this, but you know why my name's X-Ray? It's Pig Latin for Rex. That's all. I'm too blind to find anything.
I think we all three assumed that he was called X-Ray because he's the one with glasses.
Yeah. And does it even mention that he's wearing glasses at any point?
It does. It does.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, we have heard that he wears glasses.
Okay. Yeah.
But I just think it's interesting, the leader of the pack, who's so tough. Either this is extreme manipulation, but I don't think he needs to use emotional manipulation. He's already the leader of the pack. He can use physical intimidation or all kinds of things. He can withhold. He can ruin caveman's reputation. He can do other things, but he chooses to be vulnerable. And I'm interested in how sincere you think it might be.
I mean, I think it's really sweet that he opens up to caveman. Of all, I mean, the guy who's been there the least amount of time, right? And maybe that's the reason why he opens up to him. But I can't also help but think that it's emotional manipulation to try to get him to deliver to him anything that he finds. Like, please feel sorry for me. I can't see anything in my hole. So if you could just give me anything that you find, I've been here almost a year. So
maybe he just knows caveman's empathetic, so he's preying on that. I don't know. What do you think, Kristen?
Well, I think it's interesting that in the movie we don't get that little, like we talked about, we don't get that little side note of like, hey, by the way, my eyesight's really bad. And I wonder if it was because it does introduce that question of why would he share this thing with caveman of all people. And it does feel maybe a little bit manipulative.
Yeah.
Whereas cutting out that line and just saying like, I've been here for a year, I never found anything, I'm the leader, if anyone gets it, it's me. That it's so much more straightforward and to the point, which is what we get in the movie. It's just him being like, this is my due. Come on, man. He's not trying to play for sympathy.
Honestly, this might be more effective, this book version, because he knows. Also, our version of caveman in the books is different. He is more empathetic. So X-Ray reading that and preying on it might just be more effective. And then he agrees to give him the stuff, but he's torn up over it. And he says it was far more important that X-Ray think he was a good guy than it was for him to get one day off. Again, I just put like astute next to it. He's really reading what's going on here. Like, yeah, why should he get a day off instead of me? That's not fair. But my life is going to be easier in the long run if X-Ray likes me. This is very important, no matter what it takes, no matter if it's fair or not.
In the movie, it feels a bit, it feels like he's intimidated into that moment, right? Because he has a moment of saying like, well, hey, why should you get to do it? And then we kind of see the boys like maybe take a step towards him or encroach on him a little bit. And you can see that he has this moment of like, you know what, never mind. But like Allison pointed out earlier, Book Stanley is much more aware of power dynamics, and he is aware that one day off losing that is worth the trade of having X-ray's approval.
It was also an interesting way, I feel like, to phrase it, because it was said that he wants X-ray to think of him as a good guy versus that X-ray understood that he, or thought that Stanley understood the pecking order or understood that X-ray was in charge. To me, it read a little bit like, I already know that the authority here thinks I'm a bad person because I got sent here. But I think that he wants someone to understand that, like, even though they may not think that he's innocent, at least someone thinks he's, like, moral to some degree. Hmm. And so for him to say it was important that X-ray think he's a good guy, I don't know. I just thought that was an interesting choice of words because no one anymore believes that he is a good person because he's a criminal.
Perhaps he thinks he'll get farther with X-ray and the boys if X-ray has a personal bond with him rather than, oh, you fell into the pecking order. You did what I say, which is good enough on one level. But if he really sees him as a comrade and someone he can talk to, right? Like X-ray was vulnerable, whether it was genuine or not. Caveman needs to be understanding and be seen as a good guy. And maybe if he has a real friendship with X-ray, or at least X-ray values him as like a person he can trust, he immediately goes up in the pecking order.
Caveman also picks up on, again, the question that we addressed in when we were watching the movie, which was, why is X-ray the leader? We've read, what, like half of this book so far, 100 pages, and we haven't found the answer to that. And we didn't know the answer from the movie either.
All I know, this may not be the full answer, but they do say X-ray's been there the longest.
Is that in the movie? Yeah. I do not remember that. Okay, good call.
Yeah. So it might be that simple, but he's also obviously manipulative, like probably the perfect combination of being there the longest and then having the social skills to bring people under his wing and manipulate them as he goes.
I also think that his nickname, Caveman, makes a lot more sense if he's the biggest guy at camp. And it does point out that Stanley is the biggest boy at camp, even bigger than Armpit. And then his nickname starts to like make more sense to me. Like they have this idea of him as like this big hulking caveman.
Yeah.
Whereas like,
no, you're right.
In the movie, I'm always like, we went with caveman. Okay. That's not what I think of when I look at Shia LaBeouf, but yeah, that's sure. True.
Yeah. No, I think that's great. Great point.
That's a great point. So we get to chapter 12, and like Kristen said in the last episode, there's this debate about, like, Caveman comes in, and he's like, you're right, the second hole was the hardest X-ray. And he's like, nah, the third hole's the hardest. And this goes on and on. The next hole's the hardest. The next hole's the hardest. They're all hard. And we get to our first therapy session with Mom. And I just want to know, my first impression is just that Caveman has a creative solution to this whole like Jose loving to work with animals thing. He has a great idea for that, being an animal trainer. And then also that Mr. Pendansky still seems like a good counselor to me. He says, we don't laugh at people's dreams. You all can do anything you want. He's very, very supportive. So that covers several pages for me, but what do y'all think of this chapter?
He actually said something that I thought was really insightful. Because, of course, yeah, someone was making fun of Magnet and saying he's never going to be a monkey trainer. And Mom said, you don't know that. I'm not saying it's going to be easy. Nothing in life is easy, but that's no reason to give up. You'll be surprised what you can accomplish if you set your mind to it. After all, you only have one life, so you should try to make the most of it. And I actually, like, even though we know that Mom isn't a perfect person, he's really not a very good counselor or even one who is licensed. He really says something that is insightful there to me because it's true. Like, nothing
well,
in life.
On the face of it, that's not bad advice.
No, it's not.
Which
like,
is
that's
shocking
actually
from
like,
him.
Like, yeah, they probably don't get a whole lot useful from Mom, but that was useful.
And actually, for me, this whole chapter, which of course, readers, is only 1, 2, 3, 4 pages, but this whole chapter, he's giving good therapy advice to me. He even says on the last page, you're all special in your own way. You've all got something to offer.
Mm-hmm.
And then he throws it in the trash if you continue reading.
Yeah. Yeah. Then he says, you have to think about what you want to do, then do it. Even you, Zero, you're not completely worthless.
And there again, small insight into mom's character.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and it's a sharper turn because we've seen him be petty before this in the movie. We saw him take little jabs at the boys before the counseling session in the movie. In this, it kind of almost seems like it comes out of nowhere.
Yeah, it kind of does. Because this whole time he's been inspirational. Right before this, he said, and of course, prefacing this, this is not true for Stanley, but would be true for anyone else there. Mr. Pandansky says, that person is you, Stanley. You're the reason you are here. You're responsible for yourself. You messed up your life and it's up to you to fix it. No one else is going to do it for you, for any of you. That is really good life advice. Those boys need to hear that. Unfortunately, Stanley actually didn't do it. But that's something that you need to hear at a certain point.
No, on paper, this is a pretty good counsel. Yeah,
absolutely.
And then suddenly, yeah, he says that thing.
Out of freaking nowhere, he's like, except for you, I hate you.
So we get to chapter 13. And they go on more about how the third hole was the hardest, and so is the fourth hole, the fifth hole, the sixth. He's digging, and he finds Kate Barlow's lipstick tube, but he doesn't know that it's that. What happens here is, of course, he ends up giving it to X-Ray, because he kind of has to, but he doesn't want to, and he sees the KB, so he knows it's kind of special, but we don't know in the book yet that that means Kate Barlow. He just thinks, this is gold and pretty and has initials on it. Might be interesting. X-Ray takes it, and that's mostly the chapter. It ends with Stanley moved up one place in line because he gave it to X-Ray. Mm-hmm. So what additional thoughts do you have on this?
I just thought it was very sweet that he was still trying to figure out how to bypass X-Ray.
I know.
He's like, how can I maneuver this? Like, he still has enough faith in these adults that he's thinking, like, is there a way that maybe they'll explain to X-Ray that, or they'll cover for me?
Okay, wait. You mean this quote where he says, Stanley wondered about trying to secretly take the tube directly to the warden. He could explain the situation to the warden, and the warden might make up an excuse for giving him the day off so X-Ray wouldn't suspect.
I thought it was so, like, he still has so much to learn about these people. People, none of them care. None.
And we see, and when he finally does decide to give it to X-Ray, I think he really decides. We don't really see that much resistance. He's just like, yeah, you know what? Like Allison keeps bringing up, like, I think he thought this through and he realized, like, he thought through all the pros and cons and thought, I come out of this best by playing the game and giving this to X-Ray.
Yeah, he doesn't want to at all, but that's going to serve me in the long run.
Mm-hmm.
So we get to chapter 14. This is page 64, everyone. And Stanley's going to bed.
I only noted that he has a conversation with X-Ray in the morning that was cut out of it was cut out of the movie where he comes up to X-Ray in the morning and he asks him, do you still have it? And X-Ray goes, I don't know what you're talking about. And he can't figure out why X-Ray snaps at him until later, when we learn that the boys think that she has the entire place wired up with cameras. And in the movie, it's kind of a joke, and we're not even really led to believe that the boys actually believe that. You know, it's nebulous. They may or may not, or it might just kind of be like, oh yeah, she knows everything. She's got this whole place wired up. But clearly, X-Ray is like, don't talk about that. You don't know who's listening. They really do believe that she can hear every word they say.
Yeah, that absolutely was downplayed in the movie, or kind of just like an aside. But yes, in this book, they are very concerned with being monitored by the warden.
It also seems like we finally get an answer. I think we talked about this when we were watching the movie.
I'm so glad you're pointing that out. Yes.
So we were like, do they just dig wherever they want? So obviously now we have the answer. Mr. Sir marks it with his boot heel.
And they mentioned Tent E. They mention where the other boys are digging. The other boys dig about 200 yards away from them, which, again, we in the movie, you never see.
We don't even see
the other boys.
No.
On page 65, I liked this little foreshadowing. At this time of day, Stanley sometimes, this is in the morning, sometimes could see some distant hills or mountains on the other side of the lake. lake, quote unquote, they were only visible for a short while and would soon disappear behind the haze of heat and dirt. So they can't even really see God's thumb at all, but it's kind of this mystical thing in the distance, almost like a desert mirage. Like sometimes you can barely see mountains and trees, but they're so far away. Did I even see them?
Mm-hmm. No. And we note that Pendanski, when he comes and X-ray, Pendanski comes to give them water, and X-ray chooses that moment, of course, to give him the lipstick tube. And Pendanski is then supposed to be on his way to bring water to the next group. And then instead of doing that, when he's shown the lipstick tube, he's like, nope, peace out. I'm going back to the warden. And they're just like, those boys don't need water, right?
Right? Of course not. And then we get the warden's intro, which, oh, we said this before, I'll say it again, amazing casting. The way they describe her in the book.
Sounds like he's describing Sigourney Weaver.
Absolutely spot on.
A tall woman, red hair, sleeves are rolled up, arms covered with freckles, as was her face. He's just describing Sigourney Weaver.
Spot freaking on.
And this whole scene is like verbatim.
Yes. She says, excuse me, several times, and it becomes clear, especially in the book, excuse me just means shut up. It literally doesn't even mean excuse me or I need clarification, or it means I am in charge and I don't want you to talk. Did I ask you to talk? That's literally what it means. Like, will you respect my authority right now or suffer the consequences? That's what excuse me means.
I think that's exactly true. Yep.
Oh, and we get the direct quote, do you hear the empty spaces? Anything else?
This is such a, these two pages here are such a good illustration of what life actors can bring to a script.
So much.
Because you can't read that line without hearing her.
Not at all.
It's physically impossible. So true, I challenge right? you.
I agree. And I think that this gives us the most insight we've seen yet into this cyclical hierarchy thing where these two men are suffering at the warden's hands, and she makes them feel emasculated and she treats them a certain way, and then they do the same thing to the boys. And we really see now how their relationship with the warden.
It reminds me, have y'all seen How I Met Your Mother?
Mm-hmm.
It's been a long time.
So y'all remember like how Marshall gets reamed by his boss.
The chain of screaming.
Yes. Well, it's the same concept, right? He takes the beating from his boss and then he transfers it onto the young associate and like just reams. Like, you've got to find an outlet for what was just piled onto you. And so, not to make light of it necessarily, but it does remind me, whenever we are beat up upon, sometimes we feel the need to spread that pain further, right?
Yeah.
And so I think that Mr. Sir and Mom are both part of that as well.
Mm-hmm. That was a great, really good to bring in that episode. I love it. So chapter 15, basically,
pitchfork, the warden's pitchfork. Did she have that in the movie?
So just to catch the listeners up real quick, basically where we're at is that the warden is excited about finding the tube, and they're digging around X-ray's hole instead of caveman's. And now it's a whole excavation and she's there with a pitchfork. And I don't remember, she might have been holding it as like a set piece.
I think I remember her holding
like a
pitchfork
at
one
point. But she never used it. Okay.
No. Are we sure? I don't know. Are we? I will say I remember her holding a pitchfork. I'm not willing to commit to the fact that she didn't use it. But in the book, she's also just kind of, she's not really working the way that they're working. She kept walking around, looking over their shoulders, sticking her pitchfork through the dirt piles. Like, she's just being anal, not trusting them.
Are you trying to make an analogy with her and the devil, or are you trying to call out the moment where she stabs caveman in the chest, basically?
The latter is what I'm referring to.
Because that comes up later.
Oh, I definitely circled that part.
Yeah. But it made me, like, I highlighted The Warden Got a Pitchfork when I was reading because that was new to me. Mm-hmm. Like, before I read that she stabbed whoever it was, X-Ray or Caveman. Squid or Caveman.
It was Caveman.
It was Caveman?
Yeah.
Caveman got hit.
It was Caveman.
Okay.
He got both.
Nope. She's right. It was armpit that gets stabbed.
Yeah, I thought it was someone else that got stabbed.
Nope. You're right. Armpit gets stabbed. We're jumping ahead. But armpit gets stabbed. Caveman gets clubbed on the head.
Yeah.
People get real violent with farm instruments.
People get seriously injured and just like don't get real medical attention.
Oh, I can't wait to show y'all my notes from that page.
But yeah, so that was what stood out to me, like, as soon as I entered this chapter. And of course, we're made aware, just like in the movie, that she seems to have knowledge about all of these people, that they were not themselves aware of, that the warden even knew who they were, let alone their nicknames, right?
Mm-hmm. She does have, but she doesn't have perfect knowledge. In the book, she does not have perfect knowledge because she says, "Glad you're here, X-Ray. We need your sharp eyes."
I figured she said that because he had found the lipstick tube and was just like saying, you like obviously were astute and like saw that in the first place. And now we need you to find more.
And she's obviously very good at emotional manipulation as well, because she's just building him up. Like, oh, you're my good boy. You found the lipstick tube for me. You have sharp eyes. Do a good job for me again. And she does that with Caveman.
I'll buy that, yeah.
And she's just...
And which builds upon her like... you know, making sure all their canteens were filled up because they were good boys that were working so hard.
Oh, yeah. We also see a little bit, we start to see a little bit of foreshadowing in the movie. They're kind of all friends. Like, you know, like it takes Caveman some time to earn his place up in the hierarchy. But once he does, like, they're kind of all buddy-buddy. And most of the boys, other than Shia LaBeouf, are basically interchangeable, right? They're just the other boys in his camp. But in chapter 16... on page 73, we start to see a little bit of foreshadowing that Zigzag is maybe not all the way there, and not in a super kooky way, like a fun, crazy way, but like there might actually be a reason why this boy is not safe to be around.
Wait, what did you see on 73?
It's the top.
Oh,
when Zigzag's staring at the screen. And
specifically what we see is that Zigzag says, "Can you please keep it down? I'm trying to watch
TV."
Oh,
and the TV is broken.
The TV's broken.
Okay.
He's just staring at a blank screen.
So what I read this as with Zigzag was like, he's finally breaking.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know that he is specifically insane, like, or that he has mental health issues. I think that being at Camp Green Lake is finally fracturing him as a person.
I agree.
Ooh, that's interesting.
I completely agree. I don't think this is anyone that is more insane than the next person. I think we're just seeing that this shit will eventually break you.
We saw that from minute one when you see a kid like willingly go up to a rattlesnake.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Everyone has their
breaking point. No, that's a great point.
And I think
I genuinely hadn't thought of that. I just assumed it was just him being kind of wonky. But no, that makes sense.
And I would argue that Stanley and Zero are both going to break in their own way, and that's by running away from camp. So,
oh, that's a good point.
Honestly,
maybe
that's why X-Ray's in charge. He's been there the longest, and he hasn't broke yet.
Mm-hmm.
Like, or broken yet. Honestly, like he's got some mental fortitude. He's gained the system a little bit. You know?
Yeah, I'll take that. Yeah, especially because like, there's no way that you don't get some brain damage from that heat stroke. That repeated heat stroke.
So on 74 at the end, Stanley gets a letter from home and everyone's trying to read it and teasing him like, oh, is it from your mother? And it actually is. And X-Ray says, give him some space. If Caveman doesn't want to read it to us, he doesn't have to. It's probably from his girlfriend, which is a strategically bro move. He's like, Caveman really has a girlfriend. So Caveman made the right choice. He's gotten in personally with X-Ray.
He's received affirmation now. Mm-hmm. Because this is probably, bless his sweet little heart, the coolest he's ever been.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And we see him start to treat mom the same way everybody else mm-hmm. does. Pendansky tries to say, I have a letter for Stanley. And he says, my name's Caveman.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
I'm one of the guys now.
So he gets this really sweet letter from home. And his mom is actually aware that Stanley is sugarcoating things and making it sound like camp is better than it is. And then he laughs at the joke about the little old lady who lived in a shoe. Zero's like, what's funny? And we find out that Zero... Oh, no, he doesn't say yet. No, he doesn't say he can't read. There's a dance around that.
Zero doesn't understand the reference to the nursery rhyme.
Right.
Which would indicate mm-hmm. that he hasn't had a traditional education.
Exactly.
And I will...
Slash childhood.
I will just mention... Because Allison now probably understands this.
Oh, I
cannot escape Sesame Street.
Yeah, that's where I was going to.
There's a line that Stanley says, didn't you ever watch Sesame Street? And me and Allison probably watched, 3 hours of Sesame Street just today?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, just today. Yeah. My daughter's obsessed with Elmo, so...
Mm-hmm.
But it also helps me remember, because it's been a while before I had a daughter. It had been a minute since I'd seen Sesame Street. And it's true. It speaks to, because Sesame Street is totally accessible, by many different types yes. of people. Like Stanley's poor. Remember, he's poor, but Sesame Street is something you can find on the basic cable channels, back in the 90s.
It's universal. Yeah. Yes.
And so it just it shows that Zero even had less maybe than Stanley had.
So we are getting some insight. We just don't know exactly mm-hmm. what's going on. But yeah, no, that's a good way to paint. This kid has something going on. He wasn't raised the same way you were.
Mm-hmm.
And we get to chapter 17 and the warden is getting impatient. They're not finding anything around X-ray's hole. And this is when it gets savage. You guys were right. The warden jabbed at armpit with her pitchfork because he came back from going to the bathroom and it looked like he was being lazy. And the pitchfork left 3 holes in the front of his shirt and 3 tiny spots of blood. Y'all.
My notes in the margin for this are the lowercase letters WTF. Mm-hmm. I was not expecting
that. No. And they don't indicate that he got any medical attention for that.
You definitely
just
know.
What we're about to find out when Zigzag freaking hits Caveman across the head with a shovel.
Zigzag full on snaps.
Yeah, he snaps. Yeah.
And Caveman doesn't get any medical attention for this either. These boys are getting beat
I wrote
up.
WTF again, but in all caps.
Yeah. And so we addressed earlier that Zigzag is starting to lose it. And now he totally loses it. So it says... Caveman dug his shovel into the side of the hole. He scooped up some dirt and was raising it up to the surface when Zigzag's shovel caught him in the side of the head. He collapsed. He wasn't sure if he passed out or not. He looked up to see Zigzag's wild head staring down at him. I ain't digging that dirt up. That's your dirt. So it's what? Because they're sharing holes now.
They it's don't totally have- nonsensical, which means he's broken.
He's used to, my hole is 5 mm-hmm. feet deep and 5 feet wide. That is my hole. When I'm done, I'm done. And now they're all working together and he's losing it.
And they take out the boy-on-boy violence from the movie. This, yeah, I was not expecting this whole scene at all. Because it's so, it got very violent very quickly.
Yeah, and it is nonsensical. It says, when Stanley returned to his hole, Zigzag was waiting for him. That's your dirt, he said. You have to dig it up. It's covering up my dirt. He could see a small pile of dirt. It took him a moment to realize it was the dirt which had been on his shovel when he was hit.
There again, proving wow. Zigzag is not thinking clearly.
No.
Right. He's not willing to dig one single shovelful more than he feels is his responsibility.
But can I also...
Which is so bizarre.
Can I also observe that Mr. Sir patches Stanley up with a sunflower seed sack and then says, it isn't nap time.
Yeah!
Yeah. Yeah. That was when I wrote WTF. Yeah. Holy cow!
In a way, at first I was like, God, that's harsh. And then I was like, well, you're not supposed to sleep with a concussion. So
For what it's worth, that's apocryphal. You can sleep with a concussion. It won't actually hurt.
Oh, there you go. See, I didn't know that.
But I would also totally believe that Mr. Sir wouldn't know that. But also, I don't think he cares.
So it's chapter 18. We're still digging holes. I think we've basically gotten back to, yeah, they're all digging their own holes now. The warden gave up.
The side of Caveman's head has swollen up because he just got whacked in the head with a mother flipping shovel.
But he's commenting on how, like, digging isn't really bothering him as much as it used to because he's strong now.
He's fit.
He's gotten used to it.
He's not as slow.
Yes. And so he starts writing a letter to his mom and dad. And again, Zero walks into the tent, then kind of, like, stands behind him. And it says, I hate this.
I know.
He didn't care what Zero thought. Zero was nobody. So not only do we see him acclimating and understanding hierarchy, he understands it too well. He's playing into it now. Zero was nobody. Yep.
Do y'all want to read that last little paragraph or should I? The one that, like, broke all of our hearts?
Which one?
The thing that Chris made reference to at the very beginning, which was his muscles and hands weren't the only parts of his body that had toughened.
Yes.
His heart had hardened as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Just, yeah, like, exactly what we've been saying through this whole time is that he starts out very, very empathetic. It gets him into trouble. And just like he gets blisters over time, he learns maybe too well about the hierarchy and how this place works and what you have to do to survive here.
Yeah, he's acclimating, but at what cost?
And exactly.
Honestly,
but at what cost?
Like, what would you do? What would you do? If he doesn't fit in, he's going to get picked on. He's going to get hurt more. He's going to get privileges taken away. Like, it's hard to know what to do.
And like Chris pointed out, this is the first time he's been cool.
Yeah, exactly. And I do feel like maybe this is a slight deviation from the movie because I felt like in the movie, we didn't see Stanley become super hardened. The only time that we felt like maybe he wasn't as nice as he could have been was when he first turned down Zero for teaching him how to read. And so to us, that sort of came out of the blue in the movie. We were like, oh, like, we kind of expected more from you because it didn't seem like he was losing his heart along the way. But here, like, we can kind of see that gradually progress. And so, like, when Zero, like, asks him, can you teach me? It's like, I can kind of see how he would say no. Yeah. Like, he's starting to become hardened.
I completely agree with that.
Well, and in the movie, my impression of that moment was that he was, this is just my takeaway, my instinct, but that he was like kind of too embarrassed to teach. Like, that, you know, it implies that you're in a position of like more knowledge or more authority, and that he felt embarrassed. He felt like he wouldn't do a good job. And so it was easier for him to say, I'm too tired, man. I'm sorry. You know, it's just digging holes it's exhausting. I can't teach afterwards. Mm-hmm. Where, you know, when instead I thought maybe it came from a place of insecurity.
Yeah.
But now we're in his thoughts. We're learning. He flat out says he didn't have the strength to try. He needed to save his energy for the people who counted. And Zero's a zero.
Yeah. So we get to chapter 19. And I'm curious if this is supposed to build on X-ray's vulnerability or if this is different. But Caveman is awakened to Squid crying next to him. And he asks if he's okay. And he's like, what are you, my mother? I've got allergies. He's very defensive. Obviously, he doesn't want anyone to know he's crying because this is...
Yep. Doesn't get brought up again as far as
right.
we know.
And then we get to... I like this paragraph. Stanley was thankful that there were no racial problems. X-ray, Armpit, and Zero were black. He, Squid, and Zigzag were white. Magnet was Hispanic. On the lake, they were all the same reddish-brown color, the color of dirt. So we get some context. We're told it's laid out for us what race everyone is, but we're also told it doesn't matter because everyone is in the same boat and that same red, brown dirt flies on everyone and no one is better mm-hmm. than anyone else here.
No one's getting any privilege.
Yeah, exactly.
I thought it was interesting that they chose to exactly keep all of those for the movie in terms of their casting decisions.
It was spot on, wasn't it?
That was completely true to the book.
Yeah, it was exactly mm-hmm. it.
Completely mm-hmm. true.
I thought that was interesting. Oh, and this is when we see the sunflower uh-huh. seed debacle.
So can I mention for just a minute, Allison mm-hmm. is witness
Please.
This. I'm a huge sunflower seed person. So that is something, like, I love so many different flavors. Like, I eat sunflower seeds all the time. So y'all can call me Mr. Sir if it suits you. But anyways, 20 pounds, y'all, 20 pounds of sun.
What does it say 20 pounds?
So that was what it was supposedly, it weighed when, that's what the warden, said it weighed when they went to the warden. Yeah. What Mr. Sir said.
Oh, wow. Oh, okay. I missed that. Wow.
So y'all,
that's like a
what would you say, Allison? Like a feed sack full of like sunflower seeds?
It's literally like a sack of corn almost.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like huge.
That's an unbelievable amount of sunflower. I will say, I think that's like maybe something that wasn't.
That might
well
be a mistake.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. He's just like, I don't know, what's a lot of sunflower seeds? 20 pounds? Yeah. Yeah. Why not?
So totally. I understand he's quitting smoking, but that's still a lot to get through. So.
Oh, and so the boys, just like the movie, pass, you know, the seed sack around.
The 20 pound. They're just throwing it willy-nilly. A 20.
Stanley. Well, Stanley does say it's 10 pounds. It's half full. Exactly.
Oh, that's right. It's half full. Okay.
But still, you're just willy-nilly throwing 10 pounds all the way across to some other hole. I mean, okay, maybe.
Yeah, and it's not a compact 10 pounds. No. You know, they're moving around. Yeah.
And so what was different here in the book than the movie was that he takes the blame, but all the boys pile on. They're not impressed or thanking him.
That was vicious.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, when they're walking away, he's...
For the readers. Just for the readers.
Yeah, armpits like, how come you didn't share with us, caveman?
Yeah, and X-ray's like, that's cool. And then I thought you were our friend.
I thought you were our friend.
Bunch of dickweeds. Wow.
Yeah. So he gets no recognition or respect or, you know, like gratitude for taking
the fall. Again, we get like how much he's like edging toward breaking. Yeah. Because he says he was surprised that he could feel, because he feels fine. Like he's rolling away with Mr. Sir. He's about to be taken to the warden. He's in trouble. And he's like, I feel good because I get to sit in a comfortable seat in this truck.
With air conditioning.
Y'all, he's on the verge of breaking already. Yeah.
We can like, see how he ends up going after Zero. Like he's
that's
on
how
the
miserable he already is.
I would slightly disagree that I agree that that is definitely how miserable he is already, because this place, you know, strips everything from you. But I think the reason somebody like Zigzag breaks is because they can't find anything good anymore. And I think the fact that Stanley is like able to be like, okay, well, I'm out of the sun. You know, that's something. Like, I think it speaks to the fact that he's more resilient than maybe some of the other boys.
Things have been the same every single day for several weeks now, or who knows how long it's been, maybe a couple months, maybe several months, but things have been the same every single day, and he's getting hardened and he's learned to adjust to a new normal. Now things have changed and he was absolutely miserable, but suddenly being thrown, pulled out of his everyday routine that was misery, and suddenly facing the opportunity for something new and different is just like, that would pull you out of your body. Like,
well, to build upon that, it's like having no hope and no expectations.
Yeah.
Like he said, like it just benefits them to keep like things just kind of, you know, don't expect too much. Like he's expecting to just be miserable 24/7. And look, now he's in the air conditioning, like sitting in a comfortable seat. Like,
yeah.
Like that's nice.
Yeah, well, when your life sucks that hard, you have to be willing to like find anything that isn't horrific.
So it's chapter 20 and Caveman is being brought to the warden. And we are told that the warden's cabin has a bunch of holes actually dug around her own cabin, which I interpreted as perhaps she dug those.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Really?
That's how I read it. I actually thought her and maybe her grandfather, her father, like I thought that her family probably dug around the house.
Yeah, that's my best guess. I was trying to figure it out. And I'm like, I think out of their desperation, maybe they even set up camp there, a homestead there, because they thought that's where the gold might be. So they exhausted their resources there first and then started venturing out. What do you think, Kristen?
I guess I had assumed that they were the boys' holes as well. But no, you're right, because she says, it says the holes were closer together and they were different shapes and sizes, which we know is not how the boys are allowed to dig holes.
Right. It's not regulation.
Right. Those are not regulation holes. Regulation.
So Caveman comes in with Mr. Sir and it's about the same as the movie. She's like,
it's pretty much identical to the movie. Yeah.
It pretty much is. I do feel like we have a different reaction when Mr. Sir gets hurt.
So before we get there, I just want to point out that she asks Caveman to bring her her case, like the movie, and it is white with pink roses. And we keep getting these feminine descriptions of the warden, even though she's this hardened badass woman. And I just think it's interesting that her femininity is in juxtaposition with how cruel she is. It's a really interesting depiction.
Several bottles of nail polish. Like, this isn't like her one bottle like that she puts on for special occasions. Like, she's very feminine. She has several bottles.
Yeah, other jars and powders. Mm-hmm. Like, she's a feminine lady, even though she probably doesn't have anywhere to go.
Yeah, and her lipstick tubes and other jars and powders. So it says, I mean, she's got a whole makeup kit.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So. Although I do just want to point out that we talked about, speaking of her femininity, we talked about the fact that her nail polish in the movie is, it's pale pink. It's not like, it's, but in the book, it's described as dark red.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But this is my personal pet theory, my little hill that I'll die on. But I think they changed the color once we get into a visual medium and they want to draw a juxtaposition between the red of Kate, of Kiss and Kate Barlow, her red lipstick, her red dress, and the warden, who usually doesn't, she doesn't get to have that in her expression. But in the book, you have, you know, it's not a visual medium, and it does mention that the Venom nail polish is bright dark red and that she wears it pretty frequently, I think. She's wearing it the first time we see her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they mentioned her red nail polish when we first met her. Mm-hmm.
So let's jump back to what Chris said about how it's very different here in the book with the experience of Mr. Sir being struck. And he just goes through it. I have to say this was hard to read, actually. It was very, very brutal. And there's even a line where the warden, oh, she's such an interesting, compelling character. She's not a morally upright or admirable character, but she is compelling. And he is rolling off the hearth onto the rug, screaming and clutching his face with both hands. And she spoke softly, "I don't especially care about your sunflower seeds." Like, and this, that's just a small snippet of the whole scene. It's brutal. Chris, what were you thinking about this?
I mean, to me, it seemed much more like the Venom was active. When I watched the movie, I genuinely was like, like, was she making it up? Like, was it a tall tale that there was Venom in the nail polish? But here it very clearly says, like, it's only toxic while it's wet. And then she scratches him. I mean, he's on the floor.
Oh, he's, yeah.
He is writhing. His skin is crawling.
Yeah.
I mean, he has venom in his veins. Yeah. And it actually, I don't know, to me, I mean, Allison, you and I both know you get bit on the face by a rattlesnake, you're dead. I mean, there is no coming back from that. There is no antidote that you can get fast enough, really. I mean, not unless you have it like in the ranch house, right?
Mm-hmm.
But
well, we've talked about this. If you want to expand on that, Chris.
Yeah. So, I mean,
Go ahead.
At our family's ranch in South Texas, if we don't have like antidote on hand, there is an antidote for rattlesnake venom. But I mean, if you live in a rural area like they do, I mean, they talk about like they have the only water for miles. So there's not necessarily any hospital. Civilization. Yeah, there's no civilization, like, let alone a hospital.
Forever away.
So you have to assume that possibly they have rattlesnake antidote like on hand at the camp, because that's, I mean, I'm assuming that to be generous to them.
Yeah.
But that being said, I don't think that stuff costs thousands of dollars. Like, sure. If you want to be quite real, like, it is expensive to get bitten by a rattlesnake in this country. So I highly doubt Mr. Sir is getting like an antidote for this, because it would cost the warden a lot of money. But that being said, if you get bitten on certain parts of your body, the outcome is different. So you get bit on your ankle, I'm not saying you can take your sweet time, but you're going to be okay. Just make sure you go, you get the antidote.
Because it's so much lower than your heart. It has a long way to travel to get to your heart.
You get bitten above the neck and you're in a lot of trouble.
Yeah.
Like your brain, your heart, like I don't know of many cases of people getting bitten on the face and surviving, like, to be honest. So I don't know the amount. I mean, none of us know the amount of venom in that nail polish.
Yeah, I don't know at all.
I don't know that there's any safe amount to play around with. It kills your body in that area. Like, I think that he'd have like decrepit skin right there. Yeah. So anyway,
which he did in the movie. Yeah, he had
bad scratches that didn't really heal very well. But I'm talking about like your skin falling
right, necrotic off. Tissue.
Yes.
I was always of the opinion that whatever venom was in her nail polish was extremely, extremely diluted, because obviously it's extremely venomous. So I just assumed that it was the lightest possible dose, I guess.
Well, fair enough. Let's move on to chapter 21, if y'all don't mind.
So. I do want to point out really quick.
Oh, what? Go ahead.
There are no Kiss and Kate Barlow articles at all in the warden's house in the book.
That's right. She had those. So, chapter 21, Stanley is back to digging, and we hear that his great-great-grandfather had survived for 17 days, the one who was robbed by Kiss and Kate Barlow, speaking of, before he was rescued by a couple of rattlesnake hunters. And I had a question for y'all. What are rattlesnake hunters? Why are they hunting rattlesnakes? Do y'all know anything about this?
Never heard of it in my life.
I assume, people make rattlesnake boots, you know? There's no reason why someone doesn't have to hunt them.
So you think they're purely hunting them for the skin? That's a
profession? Or the meat. I mean, people eat rattlesnakes. People use rattlesnakes.
Yeah, that's true. But it's not a preferable meat. Delicacy or something you would sell. You eat rattlesnake if you're desperate or ho-dunk, basically.
Well, but this was 100 years ago, you know? Like, and they're not in a... This is at the time now when the land has dried up. The lake has already dried up. So like, there's probably not a lot of game around here. People are eating what they can.
But I guess there's a difference in eating what you can and selling what you can and being a quote unquote rattlesnake hunter.
Yeah. Like, being like a hunter and trapper is a different thing than just being like a rattlesnake hunter.
I'm like,
I do agree with that. I've never heard of somebody who just solely hunts rattlesnakes. To be honest, like, I've never heard of someone hunting rattlesnakes.
Me either.
They're usually something you come across while you're hunting other types of game.
Right. So that was interesting to me. And so we find out that his great-great-granddad found refuge on God's Thumb. No one knows what it means because he was insane. And he comes back from the wardens. we get to the end of the chapter, and y'all let me know if there's anything else you wanted to say, but basically the chapter ends with Caveman turning to Zero, who had been quietly digging in his hole since Stanley's return. Zero's hole was smaller than all the others, so we know that Zero finished Caveman's hole while he was gone.
You mean even though Zero was nobody? Bless his little heart.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Ugh. So yeah, Caveman looks around to everyone. Nobody helped him while he was gone. They all threw him under the bus. And Zero, who didn't throw him under the bus, didn't say anything, finishes whole. But of course...
Zero didn't even eat any of the sunflower seeds or participate.
He didn't do anything. But let's also recognize, I don't want to... I'm not going to put down Zero in any way. This is not me, like, doing that at all. But, of course... He's not just a guy trying to help a bro out. He's feeling guilty. So, of course, he is doing this because he knows that he stole the shoes. So I'm not saying that that's a bad... I mean, we could get into a whole discussion about egocentrism and why you do what you do. So it's not a bad thing that he did it at all just because it was to assuage his own guilt. That's not bad. Still helps everyone, but it is because he knows that he put Caveman there.
He doesn't feel guilty enough to not ask Caveman to teach him to read.
That's also true. I'm surprised at the gall. There's a lot of gall there. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You're not wrong about that. So we're at 22, chapter 22. Stanley is now the first one finished and spits in his hole because Zero's helping him. And then Zero, so Stanley says, "Why'd you help me?" Zero says, "You didn't steal the sunflower seeds," which we know means something else. And then he ends up saying, "Well, you didn't steal the sneakers either." And so he agrees to teach him to read. This goes on for several pages. I just want to point out one little quote here. For a second, so Stanley asks, "Do you know the alphabet?" For a second, he thought he saw a flash of defiance in Zero's eyes, but then it passed. And I feel like we've all felt this where we know we don't know something and someone calls us out. And for a minute, we're like on defense. Like, well, how dare you be better than me? You think you're better than me? But then he gets humbled and tells himself in his head, no, you don't know that. And he's trying to help you. Like, come on, be humble.
I related to that so much because it's hard and it hurts to like have to admit like, I'm more ignorant than you. Like, I don't know that. That's not like my thing. Like, but then I love that they did follow up with him being really good with math.
Yes.
And not just math. He's really good at pretty much everything. Once you teach him, he's a savant.
Right. But I love that even Stanley couldn't understand like the inner workings of his mind with how he got to those numbers. Like, I feel like Stanley was even struggling to like compare the math. Like, he was like, oh, is that right? Like, is that how many letters there are? Like,
yeah, listeners, if you weren't reading, like, Zero, actually, this isn't in the movie, but he ends up being sort of a math genius. He's just very naturally adept with math. So he ends up picking up like, oh, there's 26 letters in the alphabet. That means there's 40 or whatever, 52.
Yeah.
52 letters total if you count lowercase and capital. And he's kind of just really, really good at math, even though he knows nothing about the alphabet. So basically, we're just talking about how the book goes into him being a math genius. And continue.
He even figures out like, okay, so I have to learn 5 letters a day for me to accomplish this in this amount of time. Like, it's just very intuitive to him.
Yeah.
In a way that, I mean, and we've got to assume that he's learned as much about math as he has about reading, right? I mean, so he just has a real knack for it. But he's obviously extremely bright despite what mom has told us. And mom is the only, that's also maybe the difference is I feel like mom is the only one that's ever put him down. I don't think that any of the other campers have ever said anything about him that's negative.
We haven't heard anyone in the book except for mom calling him stupid or there's nothing going on there. They just kind of ignore him. That's all. Mm-hmm. They don't say anything about him, really. Yeah. That's an interesting distinction. I highlighted this. Zero must have thought he was staring for a different reason, because he said, I'll dig part of your hole every day. I can dig for about an hour, then you can teach me for an hour. And since I'm a faster digger anyway, our holes will get done about the same time. I won't have to wait for you. I think that's a super fair trade. Like, great idea. That makes a lot of sense.
It made more sense described that way here in the book than mm-hmm. it did in the movie. Not that, like, I mean, I felt like we got it in the movie, but it made more sense, like, being described that way, like, oh, like, then I won't have to wait for you. Like, I know it wears you out because you're the slowest digger out of everybody. So you get back later. And then, like, how much time do we even have after that? So
it makes so much more sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Zero says, well, Stanley's complimenting him on his math. And he says, I'm not stupid. I know everybody thinks I am. I just don't like answering their questions. And we get back to power dynamics. This is the only power Zero has. He's the smallest person in the camp. He's not educated, even though he's smart. So the only power he has is to choose to not speak. I don't have to answer your questions. I don't have to do that.
Yeah, and I think it was Kristen who pointed that out when we were analyzing the movies. Like, withholding that voice was the only power that he had. And he's pretty much saying that here.
Yeah. He's a very much, I think, like Stanley, he figured out the power dynamics like the second he got there and realized what his options were and what his options were not.
Yeah. So basically this ends with Stanley finally realizing that he has an epiphany and the KB on the lipstick tube. Well, he realizes it's a lipstick tube and that KB is Kate Barlow. That's our last thing. What do y'all think about him figuring out it's Kate Barlow? Anything in particular?
No, not really. I'm just enjoying my French kiss on that note.
Appropriately enough. Yes.
Any closing thoughts on this section before we head into the next few?
Not from me. I'm interested to see where this goes.
Yeah.
Since I've not read this section
yet. I can't remember, but I do feel like maybe our flashbacks are a little bit behind in the book versus the movie. I feel like we have found out more about the past by this point.
I think you're right.
Between Kate and Sam. And we haven't seen Sam or really Kate.
By the way, for the listeners, when we pick up with chapter 23 next time, we're starting off with a flashback to Kate and Sam. So we're going to start off with old Green Lake. Mm-hmm. That'll be super fun. But yeah, so far we have not learned much at all.
Yeah, not much. But that's why I'm really interested to see where this differs. Because those parts of the movie are so strong.
They're very memorable. They stood out to me as a young person. So
yes, agreed.
Well, much love to you, Kristen and Chris. I suppose we'll pick up soon. Listeners, you'll hear us when you hear us. This will be a long time after now. But we are so, so, so excited to cover the last half of the book with you.
Dig it out. Dig it. There.
Dig it.
ARMP out to the T. What is that, you smelly dog? That's me. I don't take showers and I don't brush my teeth. That's all I do is dig holes, eat and sleep, and get stabbed by a pitchfork.
We stinky bitches.
All right. Love you guys. Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Thanks so much for listening. If you have the time, guys, please rate and review us. It would mean the world. It bumps us up in the algorithm as a new podcast. It's huge. Also, word of mouth is going to be the biggest way to share this podcast. So if you know any decrepit millennials that need a little slice of happiness in their life, a little bump of nostalgia, please, please share with them. We would super appreciate it. All right. Tune in soon for the next episode. We love you.